Hello and welcome everyone to the fourth episode of the Greater European Talks, held inside this COVID-19 world we're in at the moment. This week we are discussing Central and Southern Europe. Now that deals with most Central European countries, the Balkans, but also Turkey and some of the other states alongside that region. Now, although there hasn't been a huge amount of new activity owing to the coronavirus, there are still very interesting news stories. And to talk about them with me today, we have Jaehoon. Say hello.
Hello.
And Lutjona. Say hello.
Hi, guys. Hello.
Perfect. So these are two wonderful new writers we have here at the Institute, and I'm very excited to start discussing this week, this month's kind of new topics. So as I believe, we have three topics we're going to focus on today. Lutjona is going to introduce about the accession of Albania and North Macedonia to the EU accession talks. And Jaehoon will be discussing some of the issues in the Czech Republic nowadays. And we're going to round off with a discussion on what's been happening with the Kosovar government. So to begin with, we're going to have Lutjona introduce our topic. Lutjona, take it away.
Thank you, Philip. So yeah, amidst this coronavirus outbreak, there was some good news for Albania and North Macedonia. The Council of Member States unanimously voted that the accession negotiations are finally opened for North Macedonia and Albania. The main cause of stalling behind of North Macedonia had been the name dispute with Greece, and the main reason that the accession negotiations were not opened in June for Albania, in June 2019, were the situation with the justice reform that's going on in the country, which has been very controversial.
I see, interesting. So why do you think it's been that France and the Netherlands, who historically were sort of against the opening earlier, why have they changed their minds?
Well, when this happened in June, France proposed several points on how to address the issue of enlargement in general. I think it could be observed in many levels. The first one was intra-EU, if we can call it so. So EU was dealing with a lot of issues such as Brexit, and enlargement wasn't always a priority. But the other issue is also from the side of Albania and North Macedonia, and mainly for Albania, the main issue was that justice reform was not perceived as the most well-applied one, and also the crime rates and organized crime had actually a lot of suspicious points of view from member states, because actually the government is having this cross-sectorial strategy against organized crime, human trafficking, and corruption.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that what we see and what we observe, actually mainly from news, local and international, is a slight increase of Albanian crime groups across Europe. So by this, I don't want to sound judgmental and don't want to increase further stereotypes of Albanians. So, but the fact is that the local EU member citizens have this kind of issues, but also point of view culturally towards Albania. So that could be an issue. And so currently France adopted the new methodology because it was built as a compromise between France's proposal and also the proposal of some countries led by Germany who were for opening a negotiation. So the methodology is built on combining and compromising between two approaches. And in fact, actually, it increases the duration of accession negotiation period for both countries. But experts say that it might lead to a more sustainable democratization of both countries.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Okay. And do you know how different this new methodology is to the old one? So then the old one, I mean, for comparison, what's happening in Montenegro and Serbia, in some cases, is kind of, 20 or 30 chapters that they have to go through slowly but surely, with everything only really coming to fruition at the end. How has the new methodology changed that?
Instead of chapters, the new methodology has actually clusters. So the chapters are still there, but they are regrouped into clusters. And the first and foremost is democratization and political criteria. So all chapters regarding political criteria and democratization will be open the first and close the last, according to this new methodology. And the methodology that Serbia and Montenegro are currently using is the old one, which means they can open chapters simultaneously without interfering, like the chapter for human rights doesn't interfere, let's say, the one for agriculture. But in this new methodology, they opted for this consecutively approach. So if the political criteria are met after some time, we can proceed, Albania and North Macedonia can proceed with opening chapters which fall under the cluster of economy and so on and so forth. And until each cluster is beside the political one, each cluster should be opened and finished. And then at the end, the chapter which is on political criteria can be closed and the countries are ready for membership. Now, having said this, it looks like a long and very prolonged period of accession negotiation talks. But in fact, as I mentioned before, there are experts who say that at the end it might end stabilocracy in the region. So having said that, it might increase accountability of citizens towards institutions to check if they are completely fulfilling with EU criteria or not, if they're keeping their electoral promises and so on. And it might foster democratization on long term and avoid situations like, for example, Hungary, which is a member state, but falling back to authoritarian regime. And at the end, Western Balkans has always experienced the so-called lessons learned from previous engagements. So this is the same case, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for example, Bulgaria and Romania in 2007. That's interesting. And what do you think is going to have an impact on future membership discussions? Like, I think in the long term, we're also looking at maybe Ukraine, maybe even like Kosovo and Bosnia, kind of their negotiations. Do you think it's going to have a long-term effect, or is it more of an immediate response to the Albanian and Macedonian question?
If we see the region as overall, the Albanian and Macedonian question are not very different from the Serbian and Montenegrin. So if it would have, to my opinion, if it would have been for a short-term and immediate response, it's the same. They could have used the same as Serbia and Montenegro because the countries in progress reports don't differ too much. And also the local situation is not very different. Some countries are doing well in some aspects, but the others still have problems, especially with democracy. And the countries, all of the countries of the region, in the latest The Economist Index of Democracy, the entire region scored lower than in 2018, and each country separately as well. So in this case, I would say that this is a new approach, long-term approach that the EU will use for also future memberships. And it's more of, to my opinion, it's more of a response of the Union itself to their enlargement policy and to check the capacity also for them to accommodate new members.
Mm-hmm. So do you think it's going to take necessarily longer or shorter? You mentioned how like it might be longer, but it might be more stable. Do you think it makes it necessarily harder?
In a way, yes, because now the public administration dealing with this, they have to also change their way of working, I mean, at an operational level. And besides that, public administration capacities need to be further improved in both countries. But I think this depends on the leadership styles that we will have and level of democracy. This is why many experts claim that it might end stabilocracy and it might improve democracy, because if we have committed leaders to the enlargement, then we will have a stop in these dual rhetorics. Philip, what happens usually is that our leaders in this part of the world, they have a different speech in English rather than that in their native language. So,
I've heard, yeah, I've, Yeah, what they might say to the EU is different to what they're saying to their own people.
Exactly.
But this you think makes it harder for them to play to different audiences.
Yes, this will put single standards to everyone. During elections, if they claim that they are pro-Europeans, then they have to commit to EU enlargement processes, and then the citizens know what their vote produced, not just as it's been so far that you vote for another promise in the elections and then things change all the way. So in this way, it can increase accountability. And if the governments comply with it and commit to it, not necessarily it can take longer. But yes, it will have, to my opinion, a greater impact to democratization, since now the conditionalities are much more clear and the main keyword of the methodology was credibility, which was a bit lost recently in this part of the region.
Okay, fantastic. Jay Hoon, anything you want to add?
I mean, I'm a Euro enthusiast. That might be also...
Of course, yeah. We've all got to be aware of our biases. Any other question you want to add, Jay Hoon?
No, I have less knowledge, unfortunately, about the Balkans. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just listened.
Oh, no worries. Okay, thank you very much, Lupiona. That was very interesting. I think we're going to keep hearing a lot more about this in the future. And, you know, with any luck, it will be quite a successful accession compared to other recent ones. So now we're going to move on to Jay Hoon. If you want to introduce your topic a little bit. And yeah, let's discuss it.
Yes, I want to talk about the recent political situation in Czechia. You know, the prime minister of the Czechia is Andrej Babiš, and he has got very complicated personality. And he became prime minister in 2017, December. And still he is running his cabinet. But there have been a lot of accusations on his name. Like some claim that he was a former agent of communists. Some claim that, you know, he is, by the way, called the second Trump. Like this, mm-hmm. Czechia's Trump. Because he has got very beautiful wife. He was the second richest businessman in Czechia. And he is also, by the way, EU critical when he's accused, like, you are EU skeptic. He says, no, I'm EU critical. We can work together. So pretty much like he's goes the same way like the Trump does. He says that, okay, we give more money, we receive less. It's not fair. And especially his actions towards the institutions of Czechia, which constitutes democracy of the Czechia, has been worrying in recent years. His judge changed, etc., etc. And this has caused mass protests in Czechia in recent story. For example, like the peak of the protests was in 2019 June, where when there were about 250,000 protesters. Mm-hmm. But the problem with these protests is that, you know, they are not well organized. And all right, they are in a weekly basis, sometimes in a monthly basis, but they are not organized well. So actually, there is no results in the end.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And the head of the one of the major head of the protesters in the is the Benjamin Roll. He's just 24 years old. You can find very little information if you Google his name. And he also looks like his opponent, I mean the prime minister, not very well organized, not having clear political story, which makes things more complicated. And I want to give the attention to the fact that in 2012, according to Slovakian National Memorial Memory Institutes, like there were articles and documents that he was actually a communist agent. So this kind of accusations really hurt his reputation. And he all the way says that it happened years ago, 10 years ago. You know, we should go forward. And under my administration, everything is perfect. He almost denies like something is wrong. He blames on his opponents, saying that, you know, because they don't want Great Czechia, kind of.
Mm-hmm. I see. Does it have much relation with the ongoing corruption case against Babiš?
Yes, he denies. He says that, we revealed the documents of the government's budgets, etc., on a yearly basis, on a monthly basis. So he thinks that by that you can get rid of all the corruption cases. Like, it's not enough, and there hasn't been any kind of any accusation of him, like corruption, something like that. He denies just all of this, and he just. Like this, he thinks that if you don't say something, it doesn't become truth. Like,
I see. And has he had as so? You mentioned kind of he's been attacking, if not changing, some of the institutions in Czechia. Could this be quite related to the other sort of Visegrad members in Poland and Hungary, or is this kind of a unique Czech twist, really?
Czech twists are unique because it doesn't happen like on all in all. That's why he changed government, like he changed judges sometimes, and according to his political party, which is the short name is ANO, which is very populist. So he basically appoints his supporters, and the people get very angry about it. But if you also look at the economic growth, you see that there is a slight stagnation, also in unemployment. Like, you cannot really blame the country situation on him because everything goes constantly. So maybe few fluctuations can be blamed even on protesters saying that, okay, they went, they didn't work. That's why there has been a slight decrease in the economic growth. But according to other countries, like neighboring countries, Poland, Hungary, these figures of economic growth are almost the same.
Mm-hmm. I see. I think it's a very interesting one. Do you think maybe the fact that Hungary, which, although it's not a neighbor, it's very closely connected, do you think the fact that Hungary is going through a lot of things right now means that people haven't put as much focus on Czechia?
Yeah, from what I see, like Hungary concerns EU more than the Czechia, and current COVID-19 measures taken by the Hungarian government especially worried the European countries because it was named like dictatorial, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, there are worse cases, which is the Hungary and the other cases, but the Czech issue, I think, is neglected very much, to me also.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. Following on from that, do you think that this, and I guess we can call it backsliding in some effect,
mm-hmm.
do you think it's going to become more symptomatic of Eastern countries in the EU, or is this actually more of just a hypocritical aspect that some of the Western countries are using?
The move of big actors in the world, such as the United States and Russia. Russia, kind of, United States got upper hand, but by kind of offering more trade deals with the EU, with other sort of trade deals by the administration of Trump, like LNG, gas supplies, and other stuff. And also by the Russia, the East occupation, Crimea occupation of Ukraine. I think this kind of countries, East European countries, most of them who were like Warsaw Pact, they got kind of upper hand in the face of EU requirements, Brussels requirements. Now they can ask for more because they know that EU stuck in between also two players, United States, Russia, and those countries. It's in a way maneuver for those countries, as Andrei Babiš said, like to ask for more money or to reject. Also, this government rejects the quotas on migrants. Like you have to accept this number of migrants.
Okay, that's very interesting. So, I mean, following on, almost linking Lutyona's topic to yours, do you think the EU also fears similar backsliding in the Balkans? And that's sort of one of the reasons they're being so harsh on Hungary, Poland, and maybe starting to become harsh on Czechia?
To be honest, it's very hard to answer. But clearly, some member states of the EU has really violated the EU values. So they have to be a clear fine line, and it doesn't stop there. Then it goes like as a parasite, like all the way through even the West.
Mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. Luke, do you have any other questions you kind of want to add to that?
Yes, I do, actually.
Go ahead.
So, once again, what are the reactions of, for example, Slovakia to the situation? Because they used to have a common history together, and so maybe Slovakian citizens are more concerned?
Yeah, Slovakian government officially kind of, they don't want to complicate the relations, and they just deny those cases sometimes reveal, sometimes deny, as was the case related to the he being the communist, and it was relieved in the archives of the Slovakian National Museum. Yes, the Slovakian government is very silent at these disputes, and it's quite understandable because he's unpredictable.
Mm-hmm. I see, interesting. And I mean, yes, Slovakia, especially at the moment with their new the parties that have just come in, it's quite a historic change. I'd be surprised if, I mean, probably right now as well, because they're trying to get into government, trying to establish an entire new way of working, really. They might take a more hard line later. Okay, well, with that, we'll move on to the next topic, which is mine. And what I want to focus on is the recent collapse of the government in Kosovo. So, as some of you may know, about 50 or so days ago, Albin Kurti won a newest election in Kosovo with the I'm going to mispronounce this, I apologise, but Vetëvend Dozje Party. Quite a
very good pronunciation.
Thank you, I try. Quite a reformist party, and definitely I think the first time they actually had the same power they had. However, a very unstable coalition. Now, the situation, especially between Kosovo and Serbia, has been quite tense since some altercations resulting in a very high tariff the Kosovar government has put on Serbian goods. And the Serbian government said they will not continue negotiations until this is reduced. The US, most importantly, has also been pushing this quite clearly. And this all came to a head when I believe only a week or a few weeks ago, a no-confidence vote was taken by which one of the coalition partners actually took part of as Kurti ousted one of their ministers, which was one of the deals that they said was part of the coalition. Therefore, Kosovo has now no government, no secure government, but instead an interim one, which in this situation right now, with coronavirus hitting, Kosovo already doesn't have some of the best healthcare in the Balkans. And I think to bring it to a wider topic, it kind of shows a bit of the failure of the EU as well to kind of keep an interest in the region, because a lot of this has been pushed by the US. Donald Trump, one of his new Balkans advisors, has had quite a hard line on the land swap agreement that has been planned in the background between the Kosovan president, Hashim Thaçi, and the government in Belgrade, in Serbia. Whereas the EU, of course, had taken the opposite approach. They don't believe this land swap agreement should go forward. And as Kurti was against it, the US, it could be argued, and I argue this actually, the US found it more favourable to have Kurti out of the picture and someone else they could negotiate with, or for that matter, Thaçi to be the main negotiator. And I mean, this is just another chapter really in the turmoil between Kosovo and Serbia. And I guess it's good we have you here. I'm interested actually to sort of pose a question to someone else here. What's the Albanian perspective on this kind of situation? Because Kurti was, correct me if I'm wrong, rather close to a lot of Albanian political circles. Is this a shock for Albania, or do they just expect this?
Well, it depends. So Albin Kurti, when he was selected, it was hope for all Albanian-speaking countries in a sense, not in a sense of having greater Albania or such ideas, but in a sense that the region entirely has seen many old elites being in power for ages now. And having new elites in power, it's almost impossible. It seems almost impossible. So when the election result was positive, even though on a very limited difference, when the election result was positive to a new party, people in Albania actually cherished that and they were in favor of it as a sign of hope and finally someone new can come to the political arena. When this happened, unfortunately, it received many negative reactions from the public, but the government or other political elite did not react because they were focusing on coronavirus. And I think I agree with your point that this is also a geopolitical game of big powers. So Albania is a small country and the government doesn't have the luxurious position to say anything for or against this non-confidence vote.
Mm-hmm.
But the public actually was very sad about the news and they criticized it.
I've heard that.
To my opinion as well, is a backlash of democracy.
Yeah, there's been a lot of stories about Kosovar people banging their pots and pans every night, just to sort of highlight the worst time for political turmoil, really.
Yeah, that is a legacy. That kind of protesting is a legacy from 80s and 90s.
The Yugoslav times, yeah.
Yeah, they were also protesting the same way when they wanted to be heard, let's say, against Belgrade government.
Yes, I heard when sort of early Milosevic ideas to move into there. But still, I think, there needs to be a government right now, especially for the coronavirus response. There needs to be something. And I know that the president has talked about a national unity government to sort of tide them over until early elections. But a lot, I think, within Kurti's party believe this just to be a power grab. And who can kind of blame them when such a situation is quite easy to be exploited? So actually the party of Kurti has refused to enter into this national unity negotiations. And as it is still the biggest party, it still does have quite a lot of sway. They're still calling for the parliament to dissolve immediately and early elections as soon as the pandemic ends. But I mean, if there's no government to help coordinate the response, the pandemic will go on for longer and everyone will be in a far worse situation. What were you going to say, Lugina?
Yeah, technically, Kurti's government is still in power.
Yes, yes, that's true.
A new government is...
It's only in no confidence, yeah.
So if they prolong the period, maybe they found this as a pragmatic way to still stay in power during the crisis. That could be one option.
Mm-hmm.
And also what I would like to point out is that, in fact, during elections, the coalition party, which is LDK,
yes,
the League for Democratic League of Kosovo, their main figure and image to collect votes was Vjosa Osmani, who is now... president of parliament in Kosovo.
Mm-hmm.
She and two other members from Democratic League of Kosovo voted against the non-confidence vote. And that says something that probably it's the old elite's game against the new... Well, at least on her behalf, it was a very good sign of integrity.
I see. And I think... you know, another wider struggle is the constitutional issue, really. Kosovo's constitution relatively new. I wouldn't call it untested, because it has certainly had lots of battles over it already. But I think, yeah, it's also one for the legal history books, really, to see how they're going to decide it. You know, Kurti's saying that the constitution says the parliament must be dissolved. And of course, you know, the president's saying, well, this is a unique situation. We have to do something now to help solve it. There's really kind of no clear way out of this. I agree with you that as the no confidence was in Kurti himself, I believe, I'm not sure if it was a governmental no confidence or a prime ministerial one, that the government right now is interim and could still sort of work. And if all else fails, you're right, it could be kind of a fallback, really. Quite a dangerous fallback, I think we can agree. But what I wonder as well is, after all this is over, you know, how is the public going to react? Because this is almost a direct confrontation between the Prime Minister and the President that we haven't seen for a while. And the reaction to this is going to be quite significant on the future of talks, really, between Serbia and Kosovo, because the public is now going to be on one side. I think, well, unfortunately, it's all in kind of a lock with the coronavirus issue. But yeah, I feel like it's emblematic of a lot of the situations across the Balkans and Europe in general, where we have kind of a constitutional, an ethnic, and a geopolitical struggle all at the same time, really. And yeah, I want to sort of push home as well. It seems like the EU has been almost completely knocked out of this negotiations, which is strange when they've been trying to deal with the situation for so long. They've tried to spearhead a lot of the negotiations, Germany especially, of course, having historic ties to negotiations in the region. And Trump, I think, sees it himself as a personal potential quick victory, as it were, for the upcoming elections. A lot of people have criticized his changing of the US advisor in the Balkans, as he wants a quick win, really, which is very dangerous to do in such a situation. But I think no one called him the most geopolitical aware leader. But still, I guess, Jaehoon, do you have any other sort of things you want to add, or do you want to, for that matter?
Thank you for your information. No, I don't have.
No, it's okay for my side, and thank you for sharing this.
Okay, well, thank you very much, both of you. Thank you, Jaehoon. Thank you, Ljubljana. And, of course, thank you, the listener. We will be back next time dealing with one of our new regions. I believe the next one is the Middle East and North Africa. However, we will find out in episode 5. So thank you very much. Please make sure to follow us on all of our social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. And best of luck. Stay safe, everyone. Stay inside and wash your hands as much as possible. Have a fantastic few weeks and months ahead. Bye.
Bye.